This is Mark Rushdooney, easy chair number 419. I'm sorry my father couldn't be here tonight, but what we are losing in quality, we decided to make up in quantity. We have quite a group here for discussion. We have Andrew Sandlin, Walter Lindsay, Susan Burns, and we have an out-of-town guest, Ingrid Dahl from Minnesota. And our special guests are Peter Hammond and Miriam Kane from Frontline Fellowship. Peter is in his annual U.S. tour right now. Those of you who are readers of the Calcedon Report are very familiar with Peter's work. There are several aspects to his work. And we want to talk about two of those areas tonight that we think are very important. One is his missions work. As you know, the church in English-speaking Africa is in many cases very oppressed. You've read about that in the Calcedon Report, especially in Sudan. There was a Calcedon team last year in Zaire. We'd also like to talk in our second session on the reformation that Peter would like to see in South Africa. Missions work is only a first step to reconstructionists. You must give the gospel, but the gospel involves far more than what is sometimes called the simple or pure gospel. It involves the whole counsel of God. And Peter is concerned with both aspects of the ministry. Peter, as a beginning, why don't you tell us about the areas of Africa that you're directly involved with in missions work?
Thank you, Mark. It's really great to be here on this. And our work in Frontline Fellowship started about 17 years ago with working into the communist countries of Mozambique and Angola, seeking to help the persecuted churches working in the war-torn conflict areas there to evangelize people on both sides of the different conflicts. So that's where we started, Mozambique and Angola, Portuguese-speaking, communist-controlled, war-torn countries where the church was persecuted, and where missionaries were banned and Bibles were forbidden. So Bible smuggling, evangelism, chaplaincy work even amongst the Christian and anti-communist forces, UNITA in Angola, RENAMO in Mozambique, we were doing chaplaincy work, evangelizing and ministering amongst them, using everything from literature evangelism through to teaching and film evangelism, gospel records, Bible distribution. And soon we got into prison ministry because we got arrested for doing this work. Our work has expanded since then to the Muslim North. Now my main personal focus is Sudan, the largest country in Africa in the grip of the longest war of the century between the Muslim Arab North and the Christian Black South. We've also worked in some animist or witchcraft-dominated areas of Africa like Rwanda. And one of the areas where we've seen the most dramatic change is, of course, Zambia, which was a communist-controlled country, which now has a Christian president who has committed the country to be a Christian republic. And so we're ministering even there. So we're going everywhere from the A to Z, from Angola to Zambia.
Peter, your organization is called Frontline Fellowship, and I think that's a fairly accurate description. Why is it called Frontline? And tell me about the complexion of your team. I believe most of them are former military personnel, or at least it began that way. So talk about this idea of your ministry to the front line. What does that mean?
Yes. Well, Frontline Fellowship began the Army base when I was doing my military service in the South African Army, South African Defense Force. We were on the border of Southwest Africa and Angola, fighting against Cubans and other communist forces that were threatening Southwest Africa, which was a South African protectorate. And I had a prayer group that met every night for Bible study and prayer throughout our 2 years in the military. We had all-night prayer meetings on occasions. We did a lot of outreaches. We had the privilege of not only leading many of the pagans and nominal Christians in our own unit to Christ, but even leading some of the captured enemy communist terrorists to Christ, many of the civilians caught in the crossfire. We also got to see the tremendous needs in conflict areas. And often in Africa, people will see the man in camouflage carrying a machine gun as a problem to be avoided, not as a man for whom Christ died and who needs the gospel. And we're convinced that soldiers need the gospel and that war zones make really effective mission fields. The one thing that I think is the biggest threat to the gospel is apathy. And apathy breeds in peace and tranquility and prosperity more. But in conflict areas, people are very alert to eternal matters and they're more responsive to the gospel. We've had wonderful response to the gospel in the conflict areas. And we saw, of course, that you could get into these areas. We got in there as soldiers, but there were no missionaries there. Thousands of soldiers, tens of thousands of soldiers. Gee, there were Russians, Cubans, East Germans, there were North Koreans, there were South Africans. All
missionaries were evangelizing everybody else, but not this whole group of soldiers.
Right.
Yeah.
So we felt, well, the Great Commission doesn't tell you to go into all the world where it's legal, peaceful, or allowed. The Great Commission doesn't stop at the barbed wire fence or the minefield or the Iron Curtain. So this really began to grip our minds, and it grew out of our prayer fellowships and our late-night prayer meetings, just as we felt convicted to pray for our enemies and to pray for the people being persecuted at their hands. But then we were challenged to put feet to our faith. So the name Frontline Fellowship grew out of, first of all, the states surrounding South Africa. Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique were called the frontline states. They called themselves the frontline states. They were in the frontline of battle against South Africa. We were in the frontline of battle against them as South African soldiers. The name Frontline Fellowship really just came, I'm sure it was inspiration from the Lord, that we would be a fellowship of people who'd been in the frontline, ministering into the frontline states, seeking to bring the gospel to soldiers and those caught in the crossfire, and those who are being persecuted. So that's really where it started. And yes, virtually all of our field staff are ex-soldiers. They've been in the military. We've got people, almost all have been in the South African military. And some have come from American backgrounds. One of our people was in the American Air Force, cruise missile launch officer who got his job signed away by President Bush. And so he joined us. And for the last 5 years, he's been launching Bibles into Angola.
You're not going to sign him away anytime soon, are
no,
you?
No, no. Okay. His job's secure with us.
Okay.
So that's really our background. We've got some Americans with us, increasing number of Americans, mostly South Africans, one Swiss person. We've had a couple of Brits in the past. It's an international mission, but it's a South African-based indigenous African mission.
As Mark mentioned, Miriam Kane is with us. What role does she play as one of your trusted co-workers?
Well, let's Miriam answer some of that, but she's been one of our best workers because Miriam's a nurse, and she was brought up in a missionary family. Miriam's parents have been missionaries to Mozambique. They were there for 10 years. She was brought up in Mozambique before the communists took over and was there in the transition time. And because of Miriam's medical background, we've used her to help actually train and get the medical corps of the Sudanese rebels, the Christian rebels in southern Sudan, trained and up and started. So her work's been key in helping us there, and especially behind the scenes in the office. Miriam, how would you add to what you've got to deal with?
Well, actually, just to come back to why our guys are from the military. You have to understand that anybody older than myself, had 2 years of conscription. So naturally, if you're getting any man from South Africa, he's going to have been through the military. Also, you must look at the terrain that we're working in. We're working out in the deep bush. The discipline, the self-initiative, the self-discipline, the perseverance that the guys get in the military are all characteristics in the survival techniques that are really helpful out there. So it's not that we go out to recruit soldiers, but they're kind of useful.
Yes, it's not a requirement, but a large part of what missionary work is all about is danger, discomfort, long distances from home, disappointments. It's all part of the job description.
Can we get another D there? That was four of them.
Well, I mean, you can see I've got a Baptist background, and alliteration is part of that.
A lot of times when you think of a missionary, you think of what you saw in the foyer of the church, where this is a missionary to a particular village in a particular country. And they describe their ministry as one of trying to encourage the local people to come to their little presentation, you know, once a week on Sunday or something. You not only go out into rural areas, but you go out into rural areas and you've expanded your ministry into a number of different. You're no longer on the border states and these frontline states. You've gone into Sudan and Zaire. You're well into the heart of Africa. How do you see yourself as a missionary, maybe different than what the common conception of a missionary, and what missionaries Are there missionaries you model yourself after, or that you particularly admire and seek to emulate?
Yes, I'm certainly very inspired by David Livingstone first and foremost. He is a missionary pioneer. What David Livingstone did was he explored and opened the way for the hinterland of Africa for others to follow into, and through his writings, through his explorations and his pioneering work, he opened up Africa for many hundreds, in fact later thousands of missionaries to come in and to also bring an end to the Islamic slave trade. Now, David Livingstone had an itinerant missionary model. I'm also very inspired, though, by the William Carey model, where he didn't only go in and minister to the people and bring them the gospel of Christ through literature and through preaching, but he sought to fight against evils that he saw there. He modeled the gospel by showing that infanticide is wrong, child sacrifice is wrong, slavery, child slavery is wrong. Burning of widows, sati, is wrong, and it needs to be not only outlawed, but written into law to protect people from this. And his heritage that William Carey left us, not just a few converts, but Bibles in the language of the local people, laws protecting them from paganism and heathenism, and colleges continuing on the tradition of biblical education. So I'd say that the verse that inspires me the most over and over is the Great Commission. We're not only to go, but we're to make disciples of all nations. We're to teach obedience to everything that the Lord has commanded. And our goal is nothing less than reformation and revival in Africa. We want to see Africa transformed. Africa needs to be saved. Not only, we don't just need people to be saved from eternal punishment, we need them to be saved from heathenism today. Islam in the north, witchcraft in the center, communism in the south. Syncretism, the mixing of Christianity with other religions, all of these need to be eradicated and rooted out. A thoroughly comprehensive Christian basis for all areas of life need to be taught. So the Great Commission lays this out. All authority has been given unto Christ. Jesus is Lord. He is Lord of all areas of life. There's not one square inch of this world that is not under the lordship of Christ. And we are wanting to apply the principles that Chalcedon has been publishing, what Dr. Rushdoony has been teaching. We want to take the principles of the Reformed faith into Africa, and we're convinced this is what they need. We've got a lot of evangelism in Africa, many converts, but not enough discipleship. And this is where our mission, I think, can make the biggest impact. We're emphasizing literature, leadership training, love and action. We're seeking to make long-term changes by investing in a few people in the leadership training and disseminating vast amounts of literature. And so I'd say William Carey and David Livingstone are the two missionaries that inspire me the most.
Would it be fair to say that you are something of a cross between David Livingstone and Indiana Jones?
I wouldn't say that.
Maybe other people would. Is it fair to say that modern evangelicals as a whole, as you see it, do not have this comprehensive approach that you've mentioned about applying the faith across the entire spectrum of life, that has been lost, for example, from the 19th century missionaries into the modern era?
Absolutely. I mean, reading the writings of David Livingstone, William Carey, and Hudson Taylor, it's quite clear. They went out planning to conquer nations. They saw the prophecies in the scripture that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess, and that all the kings of the earth will bow down and worship the Lord, and that there will be complete eradication of all the false gods, and there will only be one Lord worshipped, that the nations will stream to Mount Zion and receive the law from the Lord. And they believed that the Bible was prophesying that the gospel would triumph throughout the whole world. The Great Commission would be fulfilled. Amen. And they went out under the full expectation of achieving it. And they did. They did conquer nations. They did bring kings to Christ. And they brought whole tribes and nations to the Lord. This century, we seem to be convinced things are going to get worse and worse, and Christians are going to get smaller and smaller and weaker, and the Antichrist is going to take everything over, and there might be a last-minute 7th Cavalry rescue by the rapture. And this kind of escapist, defeatist, retreatist, mindless Christianity seems to, or excuse for it, has taken root.
And it doesn't seem to be compatible with a genuine missionary zeal, does it?
No, because in fact, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You expect defeat, you get it. If you expect if you expect victory and you work for victory, it's amazing how the Lord rewards such faith. But if we go out in unbelief and we don't expect to get more than a few brands from the fire, then that's probably all we'll get. And Africa has seen this. Africa went from, at the beginning of this century, only 10 million Christians in the whole continent to today over 300 million. I mean, Africa has grown tremendously, but I'm afraid it's often miles wide and inches deep. We need more depth. In the last century, there was more depth. And today it seems to be accept Jesus. The guy can accept Jesus, but he goes to church on Sunday and the witch doctor on Monday. Syncretism. We've got to get people to destroy their idols. Again, the book Idols for Destruction has this vital message. We've got to destroy the idols. And we require people to burn their witchcraft charms and make a clear public break with heathenism. Amen. And people are willing to do it, but they so seldom are challenged to.
But also on that point, if they're going to the witch doctor on Monday, they have needs that need to be met. Many times those are medical needs. They're going because they're sick, or their child is sick, or there's an accident or something. And unless the Christians are going in there with hospitals, or going in and teaching about the herbs that they have in that area that they can use or something, we're saying, yeah, come and accept Christ, but we're not going to worry about any of your physical needs. And we need to be focusing on those as well.
That's what I call a biblical social gospel. Of course, the liberals have set forth a social gospel which is not theologically sound, and we oppose that, but certainly there's a biblical form of the social gospel, applying the faith in all areas of life, including to people's physical needs.
When I first started doing this work, I was going into Mozambique back in 1982, and I was, at that stage, premillennial, rapture-focused, believing the world was coming to an end any moment. I was very much an Arminian. I had no real concept of the sovereignty of God. I felt personally responsible for everyone's salvation, both positively and negatively. And I did a lot of evangelism, but I didn't do discipleship. And my motto was, why should anyone hear the gospel twice when someone else hasn't heard it once? Which is a bit of a half-truth, because you can't proclaim the gospel in just one session. It takes a lot more than that. But nevertheless, what I had was a very superficial understanding of the Great Commission. I was going out there to make converts. I didn't understand the need to make disciples and teach obedience. But as I saw the burnt-out villages, and I walked in what you can only call a killing fields, and came across people whose whole villages had been destroyed, their church had been destroyed, and I saw the church had been targeted for annihilation. And then in speaking to them, I found out they'd been preaching the same kind of superficial gospel I had. And don't get involved in politics, don't get involved in anything controversial, all we can do is pray. They hadn't resisted the Marxists taking over their country. Now, father had been shipped off to concentration camp, brother had been taken off to do forced labor in the sugarcane plantations in Cuba, pastors being crucified, the church has been burnt, their Bibles have been confiscated. What are they to do now? They're completely and utterly without answers. And I realized that, that my pietistic evangelicalism didn't have answers for the real issues facing a church in Mozambique that was facing annihilation by a totalitarian antichrist state. And it was my traumatic experience in Mozambique that made me dissatisfied with my understanding of the gospel, forced me back into the Bible, led me into the writings of Calvin, and I was grateful for the writings of Francis Schaeffer, getting me to ask a lot of the questions that got me thinking along the lines of the Bible's got the answer. And this led me to, later on, Productive Christians and Age of Guilt Manipulators of Chilton. That really helped me. War Psalms of the Prince of Peace by James Adams really gave me a lot of answers too, as I realized, yes, the Psalms, I must pray the Psalms against
yes.
evil. And the Lord led me more and more into the Psalms and Revelation, and seeing the victory of Christ of all persecutors. And then, by God's grace, I was linked up with Chalcedon, and I saw your writings, and things came into place. It took several years, but I moved to a thoroughly reformed position. I came to see that we're not called to defeat, but victory. We're not waiting for the Antichrist. We're serving Christ. We're looking forward to his kingdom triumphing throughout the world. And we start to put more emphasis on leadership training, discipleship. We start taking whole Bibles, not just the New Testament, and didn't just hand out tracts, but we ran seminars and courses, and we started to plan long term. But part of this is when I saw the need for what Miriam was talking about, the love in action. What do we do, as James says, when we see a brother who is in need? When and so we start to take some medicines and start taking some clothes and food and love boxes, packs of important foods and salt and soap and things people needed, and giving them out, showing we cared. And this the Lord blessed so much. And we saw, in fact, as I went back to the missionaries of the last century, I discovered the strategy of missions in the last century was minister to body, mind, and spirit. The first thing the missionaries tend to open up was a clinic. Next thing that opened up was a school. Third thing that opened up was a church. Because they first had to establish the biblical credentials of love. Then they ministered to the mind, and finally they ministered to the soul as people start to come to Christ. These days, we go and hold an evangelistic rally and establish a church, and it's a gospel hall. It's not
right.
It's not a discipleship center. We're not ministering to body, mind, and spirit these days. So our mission's tried now to go back to the last century, 19th century missionary model, body, mind, and spirit. And that's part of the reason why we are working like we are. And we also are being itinerant, because we're ministering in countries where the gospel is illegal, Muslim and communist countries. You can't stay in one spot easily. You've got to keep moving. And so we do a bit of a rotation, and we've got to stay unpredictable as far as the governments are concerned, or we could curtail our work. So that's probably another reason why our ministry is more itinerant in some ways. But we keep coming back to the same areas, and we build on previous foundations.
That's a criticism a lot of people have of you. You're a lawbreaker.
Yes. We are. Absolutely. It's true. We have to make a big distinction between God's law, capital L, and man's law, small l. When I first started going to Mozambique, I had this problem. People came to me. Romans 13. You've got to obey the government. It's against the law to go into Mozambique with Bibles. It's against the law to be a missionary and to go into Mozambique. It's against the law to have under 18s in church in Mozambique. It's against the law to baptize under 18s. And it's against the law to preach a message in a church in Mozambique unless it's a government-sponsored church and you're a government-certified minister and your sermon's been vetted by the secret police the week before. I mean, in every sense, we were breaking the law of the Marxist state, the Marxist-Leninist government of Mozambique. And now in Sudan, we're smuggling Bibles into an Islamic state. The National Islamic Front government forbids Bibles. In fact, since 1964, all missionaries have been forbidden in southern Sudan by law, the Church Missionary Act. Not only that, Bibles are forbidden. It's not just the Muslim government that forbids us to take in Bibles. It is, in fact, the United Nations. They forbid us to take in Bibles. How do we as Christians handle this? And I'd venture to say the average evangelical can't handle it. He doesn't have an understanding of what's the basis for biblical law. And so we've got to go back to the books of by what standard and by this standard. We've got to go back to the fact of the only foundation for law is biblical law. The government doesn't have a blank check. A clear reading of Romans 13 says more to the government than it says to the citizens. The government is to be a minister of God. The government is to be the deacon of God. The government is to be an agent of wrath against evildoers. The government is to commend those who do right. The government isn't to do evil. God didn't give it a blank check to do whatever he wants. And so, bluntly speaking, if people want to take Romans 13 and justify it to mean that you've got to obey any government in any sense, they haven't faced the reality of life in, say, Sudan today. If you were in Sudan and you had had your pastor crucified, your church burnt, your well poisoned, your crops razed to the ground, your cattle looted and taken away by the government forces. Your children are now being taken away by force to the Kalwa, to the Quranic concentration school, where they are going to be taught to be Arabs and to be Muslims, to recite the Islamic creed, and to dissociate themselves from the Christian faith, and later to be brainwashed to fight against their own Christian people for Islam. If that was your experience, at what point would you resist and fight? Now, a person who says you've got to obey the government, they don't believe that. They just mean they've never faced a situation so radical that they've had to face up to the fact that, listen, just like you get false ministers in a church, you get false ministers in government. God has established the authorities, but that doesn't mean that every government is an authority. Some governments are just a power. In fact, they're a bunch of bandits there with no authority whatsoever, because the only law that's valid is law that's in accordance with God's law. But if a man doesn't go back to the Reformed faith and study the scriptures carefully, he can't really answer why. On some cases, you can disobey some laws, and others cases, you must obey the law. Because to them, the law is whatever man says it is. But I say the law is what God says it is. It's God's law. If man's law and God's law are in conflict, we must obey God rather than man. That's the way we believe.
Could you be a little bit more specific? You said something about the United Nations forbidding Bibles into southern Sudan. In what way have they done that?
The United Nations have their largest, their most expensive food program in the world going on in Sudan. It's called Operation Lifeline Sudan, OLS. So far, it's cost them over $2 billion US dollars. That's billion with a B. $2 billion, and some people are dying of starvation at the same rate now as they were before the UN stepped in. And one can't exactly work out what the United Nations has been doing there for the last 10 years.
Well, they probably don't know either.
Because they certainly haven't improved the situation, but they've built up a bloated bureaucracy that one thing they're doing is they're actually feeding the government garrisons in the besieged towns. So they're basically prolonging the war by feeding the Arab troops besieged in the south and therefore enabling them to hold out for so much longer. But that's another matter. What the United Nations is doing there is they're interfering with something that I'm sure they've got no mandate to do. And they say, well, we're just enforcing the law of the government of Sudan. No Bibles into Sudan. But that's not actually correct, because on the same OLS flights, United Nations flights, they're carrying in beer and wine for the UN workers inside Sudan, which is also in breach of the Islamic law, the Sharia law of the government of Sudan. So they're being selective. They'll say, no, we're enforcing the law, no Bibles. But they're breaking the law when it comes to alcohol. On another line, they may say, well, we can't allow religious books to be carried in, but they've allowed Qurans to be transported, and their planes going to Wau and Juba, government garrison towns besieged. So they're totally inconsistent. To show you how petty these United Nations officials are, they actually have forbidden all flights for a Christian relief agency. The largest Christian relief agency working to southern Sudan is ACROSS, a British-based group. And they forbade ACROSS to fly any relief aid for a month into Sudan because one of their people on one of their flights had been found to have some Bibles in his possession. And the pettiness of these people was to forbid the largest relief agency there no flights for a month. I mean, this means thousands, tens of thousands of people dependent for survival on the aid these people flying in was just curtailed for a month arbitrarily for no other reason than that the UN hated Bibles. In fact, I just recently saw a written item off the internet from the United Nations OLS where they stated if they knew of a humanitarian relief agency, their words, flying into Sudan without authorization, they would notify the government of Sudan to intercept that flight. I mean, written, they've stated this as their policy. And we believe that they have done just that on our people. One of our teams was hit by helicopter gunships as they landed in the Nuba Mountains in Sudan, and these gunships rocketed, strafed and bombed them, killed civilians in the presence of our people as they were delivering Bibles and relief aid to the beleaguered Christians in Nuba Mountains. And MiG jets were scrambled to try and shoot down a flight that I was on once as well. We had to take evasive action through a neighboring country to avoid this. And we believe on both occasions that the United Nations probably notified the government of our flight, somehow found out about it, and tried to get us intercepted. So it's a very serious matter what the UN's trying to do in forbidding Bibles.
Peter, we want to get on to some of your other aspects of your ministry, but could you give us a synopsis of your ministry in Sudan, why you're there, what's going on with the government and the Christians? We know there's a long warfare going on there, and you've been sneaking in Bibles and ministering there, because this is a real hot spot. Could you kind of summarize what's going on there and what the current status is?
Yes, Sudan's the largest country in Africa, and it's in the grip of the longest war of the century. Since 1955, the Muslim Arab North has been attacking the Christian Black South, and the Christians in the Nuba Mountains, which is in central Sudan, a little island of Christianity in a sea of Islam. And these Christians in the Nuba Mountains, southern Sudan, are suffering the very worst persecution in the world today. Most of the villages in the Nuba Mountains have been burnt to the ground. Most of the church have been destroyed. Most of the pastors have been killed. Most of their crops have been destroyed. Most of their livestock has been looted. People have literally been crucified. Hundreds of men have been crucified in the Nuba Mountains. Children are being led away as slaves by the tens of thousands. There's been a kidnapping of children and forcing them to become Muslims. So we're talking about a very intense, serious, systematic campaign of scorched earth and of, in effect, genocide. They're trying to wipe out Christianity in Sudan. Sudan is run by a fundamentalist radical Muslim government called the National Islamic Front, and under General al-Bashir. These people are so radical, they're even using chemical warfare, such as gas, mustard gas, and at least, so much so that we even have to equip our missionaries now with gas masks that are going to Sudan. And in Sudan, we work on three levels. literature distribution. We've smuggled in over 90,000 Bibles and Christian books already into Sudan in 21 languages over the last 3 years. That breaks down to about 54,000 Bibles and 13,000 hymn books and 9,000 prayer books and catechisms, and then lots more other books, including Chalcedon books, which we've taken in for libraries. So the literature is the one side, and we don't just deliver it, we distribute it right down to the local congregation, across the rivers into a forward unit, and so on. Leadership training, we've trained a whole range of leaders. The one is the medical people. We found no medics at all, no hospitals functioning when we started in the whole areas we were working. So Miriam and I worked on training a core of medical people in first aid, basic breathing, bleeding, breakages and burns, in disease infection control. And these medics formed the beginning of a medical corps in southern Sudan. We established or repaired three clinics, brought in another relief agency to start a hospital. We've taken a four-wheel drive ambulance. So that's what's been done on the love and action side there. Medical, taken in a lot of relief aid on that side, seed and agricultural materials too. Then we've trained teachers, run biblical worldview seminars for teachers. We've run Reformation and Revival seminars for chaplains, and there were no chaplains there when we started, but now there are 36 chaplains and chaplain assistants working.
These indigenous peoples?
Yes. Sudanese, black Christians amongst the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. So the SPLA chaplains, now recognized by their high command and having full authority to preach the word, and in compulsory church services amongst the troops. All troops of all ranks must attend the chaplain services several times a week. We've seen it from the, I've met up to the second in command of the SPLA, and they take their hats off and they pray with the men, and they've even said all of our victories date back to the time when Frontline Fellowship started to bring Bibles, when we appointed chaplains, and when prayers were said. God is blessing us with victory. And in fact, that's been our observation. God really has been blessing them in the last 2 years tremendously. We've done a lot of evangelism. Frontline Fellowship's done at least 1,000 church services and meetings inside Sudan in the last 3 years. A lot of seminars, pastors training courses, and so on. So we work under three L's: literature, leadership training, love and action, throughout southern and central Sudan.
Do you expect that the southern Sudanese will be independent as a Christian or Christian-influenced nation before too long? You spoke of victories.
I believe so. I really believe so. I wouldn't have said this a year ago, but there's been such dramatic reversal of fortunes, and the South Sudanese are no longer just fighting for survival, which they were when we started, but God has answered the prayers of Christians all over the world who've started to focus on him, and now there's a chance they really could be fighting for liberation. And southern Sudan, I think, must go independent. They must redraw the map. Good borders make good neighbors in this case. The Muslim Arab North has nothing in common with the Christian Black South.
And they have a great history, I mean, a great Christian heritage in the
South.
They
do, absolutely. Yeah. So southern Sudan, I think, will succeed militarily to achieve independence, and they will redraw the map, and I presume somewhere along the line they'll declare independence, and I hope that there'll be friends in America to push for your government to recognize the independence in southern Sudan. After all, Eritrea, Croatia, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, they managed to redraw the map and have their independence recognized. Why not southern Sudan? So I do believe that. However, it'll be a lot tougher battle for the Nuba Mountains. The Christians who are behind the lines, the Arabic-speaking Christians in the center of Sudan, I can't see the government of Sudan allowing them to go free. That will be a pretty long, ongoing war of survival. But the first step is southern Sudan to be free. The next step would be to see if we can get the Nuba Mountains to have some form of recognized independence as well. That would be a much harder battle, but this is no longer impossible. It's feasible, and we've even been asked by commissioners and governors in the south to please provide suggestions on a future Christian constitution of southern Sudan, and we are starting to submit these, and we've even started running God and government seminars for some of the civil authorities to lay down biblical principles of checks and balances and separation of powers for when they could achieve their independence. And we really believe within the next 2 years one could see this come about.
How much impact has the gospel had on the peoples in these parts of Sudan? Are people nominally Christian, or do you see evidence of real faith expressing itself in their culture?
I see evidence of real faith. There's different ways. One thing is you don't really have to worry about locking up your goods. Things are safe. You can, in fact, we even did this because somebody said you could do it. I dropped my wallet arbitrarily through the window near the marketplace as I was driving out for the day, and the next day someone came and brought it back and said, somebody found this, and is this yours? And literally, the honesty is renowned of some parts where the gospel's really been strong, like the model people, the way I was talking about now. We have seen, in a war situation, it's extraordinary to have men in arms, barefoot and tattered, walking down the road and not using their weapons to extort something out of the local people. First of all, we've seen the soldiers are as thin as the local population. Secondly, we've seen that the soldiers are as tattered as the local population. They don't have the best of everything. And we've never, with all of our driving around on motorbikes, cars, bicycles, ever had someone try to use force or intimidate us into giving them either a lift or giving us them the vehicle. It's that in a war situation in Africa is testimony already that the gospel's had an impact for sure.
Nelson Mandela was recently here in the United States and spoke to great accolades in our Congress. Your headquarters is in South Africa, and you do a lot of work there. Would you tell us, Peter, what's going on there on the South African front and what Frontline is doing?
Yes, well, Frontline Fellowship is a South African-based mission. We're an indigenous South African mission, and our headquarters in Cape Town, and the parliament's just down the road, and we've felt forced to speak to a lot of the social issues in South Africa, a lot of the social evils, a lot of the corruptions and wickedness in government, and our vision is Reformation Revival in South Africa. So we are networked together with groups like United Christian Action, which is a broad coalition, an umbrella group for about 20 different Bible-based groups, all concerned for reformation and revival in South Africa. We've cooperated with a group of alliances like the National Alliance for Life, in fact, we helped bring it about, and groups like the Christian Voice, which have marched to Parliament protesting against attempts to legalize abortion or pornography or to introduce a secular state, removing references to Almighty God from our constitution. And even recently, when they tried to close down all Christian radio stations in South Africa, Nelson Mandela's latest, we marched to Parliament, 20,000 strong, to protest that. In South Africa, we spend most of our time with Christian radio programs teaching biblical principles for all areas of life, economics, education, entertainment, and so on. And deputations to government. Miriam's done a lot of deputations on the pro-life issue, trying to stop the legalization of abortion in our country. Been very involved also in South Africa in trying to speak out against the evils and give Christian alternatives. So we've run biblical worldview seminars and Christian culture conferences in South Africa to try and give alternative. And we do this because our missionary base is South Africa, our missionary sending base, where the Bibles often are printed, where the gospel radio broadcasts go from, where our people, most of our staff come from. And if our country is taken over by paganism, this is going to dramatically affect the missionary work across the border, obviously. So we are committed to fighting in South Africa against evil. And, you know, Nelson Mandela's government gets tremendous accolades in America, but I don't know why. I heard Newt Gingrich and others were praising him as a modern George Washington. Well, that is laughably ridiculous. Your George Washington was a God-fearing Christian. With a biblical worldview. Nelson Mandela is a pagan, humanist, evolutionist, atheist who is completely committed to a pagan philosophy. For example, just to give you a couple of facts, he's the one who's pushed through the legalization of abortion, pornography, homosexuality, trying to get the Bible out of schools, trying to close down Christian radio stations. The man is a complete and utter reprobate in every sense of the word, seen by the incredible explosion of crime and corruption in our country.
And a documented terrorist, actually.
Yes, he's a lawyer like your president, and he pleaded guilty to 156 acts of violence, public bombings. He was the founder of Umkhonto we Sizwe, the terrorist wing of the ANC, trained by Algerian and Cuban secret police. And this man pleaded guilty in a court of law to 156 bombings. Now, I mean, this man is no George Washington. He's a murderer. In fact, his government has released the terrorists convicted in a court of law of the St. James Church attack. a church where 11 people were murdered and 55 crippled and injured by these terrorists, to burst into churches without any warning, hurtle hand grenades into the midst of people and open fire with machine guns. These people have now been set free by our government, by Nelson Mandela. He also set free the murderers who stabbed the American Fulbright scholar Amy Beale 80 times. They've been just set free on under his amnesty. And for his birthday, his 80th birthday, he set free a whole lot of murderers and criminals who within the week were raping and murdering individuals and going back into prison. So that's his birthday present to our country. I think Americans should just pay attention to who his friends are. His friends are Yasser Arafat, Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, Fidel Castro. They've been the ones welcomed and given accolades in South Africa. He hates America. He hates everything you stand for. He curses and despises you. And then when he comes to America with his begging bowl, he gets a congressional medal for being an enemy of everything America stands for. I really question the sanity of leaders in America when they can welcome such a avowed enemy of the gospel of Christ and enemy of your country.
I question the sanity most of the time, but
yes. That's
what a lot of people have the idea that South Africa is the most Christian country in the world. And they would ask, why do you need to reform South Africa? They think it's a Christian, basically it's got a strong Christian base. Mm-hmm. All right, since the revolution, it's the politics, they may have a problem with that and recognize that the fact that there's a different element running the country, but they think at heart there's a strong Christian base there. So they would say, why do you need to work in your own country?
Well, South Africa, in fact, has a wonderful Christian heritage. It was founded by Dutch Reformed settlers, French Huguenots fleeing persecution. France came there for religious liberty. And, for example, just to go back to when I was being brought up, Rhodesia, I was first brought up in Rhodesia, but when I came back to South Africa, all the cinemas were closed every Sunday in honor of the Sabbath, so were the shops closed on Sundays. The Lord's Day was honored by law. In our schools, in fact, most of our schools to this day, it's still true, but all of our schools in the past were begun every day in Bible reading and prayer and hymn singing, Christian hymns, prayers in the name of Christ. Bible education is, even now, still in most of our schools, but they're trying to get it out. The Bible education curriculum in many South African schools actually has written in the curriculum, this curriculum is designed to bring every student a personal knowledge of Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. A lot of our schooling is actually very Christian, even the government schools, although obviously they're trying to reverse that right now very, very forcefully. Pornography was banned until recently. Abortion has been banned until recently. The legalization came formally in on the 1st of February last year by Nelson Mandela's personal intervention and by forcing it through as a party vote that nobody could even vote according to their conscience. His parliamentarians had to vote for it or lose their jobs. I mean, that's how determined Mandela was to push through abortion. So South Africa did have a Christian heritage. For example, when I went into the South African army, Bibles were issued to every troop by the army. I mean, Bibles were part of your kit. It was part of your inspection. It had to be there with you at all times or you were not properly equipped. Devotions were enforced. Quiet times were enforced in your training. Chaplain services were compulsory. Blasphemy was seriously punished by the South African military. In fact, I know of officers who literally lost their rank over a blasphemy that was prosecuted. So the South African military had a very strong Christian foundation. For example, tithing was enforced. They literally took your tithes, and it didn't go to the military or to the chaplaincy. It went to Bible production through the Bible Society. The South African Army funded more Bible translations and Bible purchases than any other institutional mission in the country. The South African Army was distributing hundreds of thousands of Bibles a year, funded by the tithes of its troops. So there was a lot of Christian heritage in the country, but the trouble is, our people sat back. The government does what's right. The government bans what's wrong. If it's legal, it must be right. And this kind of, unfortunately, let a lot of people take this for granted, including myself. I did not understand the importance of the Lord's Day or of our Christian holidays or of all this. And only when it was taken away and the new government has come in and reversed things have I seen the devastating impact and why we needed those laws and how good we had it in the past. But unfortunately, what it has led to is many South Africans aren't fighting evil. They believe that, well, if it's legal, it must be right. And so we need a tremendous revival of the fear of the Lord and teaching of the Word of God to get back to our Christian heritage. But the foundation's there.
Last summer, Chalcedon sent a team of men to Zambia, the only officially Christian nation on the planet, as far as we know. Mm. Peter, give us a background of the remarkable transformation that has occurred there and give us a little historical perspective on what's happened there and also what you're doing in Zambia and some special plans that you have for Zambia.
Wow, yes, that's a lot. But Zambia, the first missionary to Zambia was David Livingstone. He walked across the length and breadth of Zambia a few times. And in fact, he's buried in Zambia, or his heart is buried in Zambia. His body was embalmed and taken off to England, where it is in the cathedral. But Zambia was at one time Northern Rhodesia. It was one of the most prosperous and promising countries in Central Africa. The British left it with something ridiculous like £2 billion in the treasury at independence. But within just a few years, Kenneth Kaunda, a socialist dictator, Marxist, with alliances with the Soviet Union, turned Zambia into a total and utter basket case. They wrecked this country, which was a model country. And unfortunately, in 26 years of a one-party dictatorship, Kenneth Kaunda had ruined that country, devastated it. And it was a laughingstock, an economic basket case. You couldn't exaggerate the destruction of everything, from initiative to the economy, the infrastructure, the roads potholed, everything ruined, not a lift working, an elevator anywhere in the city working. Everything was just a mess. I was first going into Zambia as a missionary back in 1987, and I was locked up within literally hours of crossing the border for the crime of smuggling Bibles across them into neighboring Mozambique. And I ended up in their prison and all kinds of abuse and experiences there, and saw Zambian justice firsthand when I saw that most of the people in prison had never even been to trial. Some had been waiting 8 years to get to trial, and there they were in the prisons. So I saw the tremendous injustice and evil. What I didn't realize was some of the next government of Zambia were in our cells. General Godfrey Miandu became the vice president of Zambia, was in our cell. The present president of Zambia was then locked up a few cells down the way. I didn't specifically meet him then, but he was in the same prison at the same time, and that was Frederick Chiluba. And little did I know that God would turn this communist nation of Zambia, this country that used to send out terrorists and that sent bombers and hatred and Marxism out to its neighboring states, causing the deaths and injuries of hundreds of thousands of people ultimately, that God would turn this nation around. And now they've got a president who was elected by the first multi-party free elections in Zambia's history, 1991. In fact, elections were held on 31st of October, Reformation Day, which is wonderful how the Lord started a Reformation in Zambia on the anniversary of when Martin Luther had nailed his 95 Theses up. So Zambia's in the middle of a tremendous revival right now of coming out of a Marxist and occultic background into the gospel. But of course, the challenge is enormous. The devastation is great. The president's a Christian. Some of his cabinet ministers are Christians. He's made commitments. The schools are open to the gospel. But the textbooks are still humanist, secular, evolutionary textbooks. I mean, we've got to change the textbooks. The museums still have 16 billion years ago evolutionary nonsense. We've got to change the museums. But the gospel's on the radio. The gospel's on TV. The schools are opening in prayer and having evangelism. We get into the schools as much as we want. They're offering schools to any missionary who wants. Run our schools. Give you the people, give you the buildings. I mean, Zambia knows they're in a mess, and they're trying to get out of it. But unfortunately, good intentions won't be enough. We need to have a permanent mission station help these people with reformation and revival. So far, we're doing a lot of evangelistic courses, a lot of leadership training courses. At the moment, our field director, Robert, is traveling throughout Zambia running 18 different biblical worldview seminars in different towns and centers of Zambia. We're aiming to put a Bible college in Zambia early next year, and to help further making it a literature depot to get more of the Reformation materials out throughout the country. But seriously, the challenge in Zambia is there. We need teachers, We need missionaries. We need people to help them even not only restructure their curriculum, their textbooks, but even their museums. Zambia's wide open, but it's a window of opportunity. We need to take advantage right now.
As we conclude, Peter, what would you say to those listening to this tape, American Christians committed to the faith, about Africa and its potential and its future and what they can do to be involved?
I believe Africa's got the greatest potential for Reformation revival, although it's the most politically unstable continent with the most amount of wars. We've got about 15 or 16 wars going on right now, 49 dictatorships. I mean, Africa's a mess in many different ways, but the hunger for the gospel, the openness for the gospel is great. And bad times are good for spiritual ministry. The people are open. Apathy is at a low level. spiritual hunger is at a high level. So although Africa is primitive and poor and in many times in chaos, yet what we can achieve there is great. In any village, you can go with next to no warning and have a big turnout at a meeting, a crusade, a seminar. You can have pastors turn out to a conference without much effort. It's a tremendously
to what do you attribute area. That willingness to yeah, what do you attribute that to?
Well, for one thing, they're not saturated by media like you are here. Forget about satellite TV and all the rest of it. They often only have one channel TV for a couple of hours a day, and it's nonsense anyway, and it's not much temptation to waste your time on. They're not saturated by, they might have one radio station in the country.
Usually government operated, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the people are hungry for literature and are hungry for training and education. That's part of it. I don't know if Miriam, you'd add any other things about hunger in Africa or what we could attribute it to.
I think two people have come out of, well, particularly in Zambia, 27 years of socialism. They've seen it doesn't work, and they're looking for something else. And the gospel fills that need in their lives. They've come out of witchcraft. They've tried witchcraft. They know it doesn't work. Here in the West, people are prosperous. They don't need God. They're complacent. And therefore, they don't see that they can dampen down that need for God within themselves. In Africa, every day is a struggle to live. And therefore, they do recognize that they need somebody outside of themselves who will be their protector, be their Lord, be their master. You know.
I want to mention before we close that if you would like to support Frontline Fellowship, you can send checks to CalSeed and designate them Frontline Fellowship, and we'll make sure that all of the money gets to Peter Hammond and his work.
Yes, we are attempting right now to help Peter establish a permanent mission base in Zambia for his work and education, agricultural training, leadership training, and the like. And if you'd like to do that, send it in and designate it to Frontline Fellowship or use the name Peter Hammond, and we'll make sure it gets there. Thank you all for listening, and God bless.